Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games as all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Caring about the debt is for losers. At least that's what I used to think for like the last 20 years. But then something changed. We all became losers. At least that's what Jordan Weissman, staff writer and editor at The Argument, wants you to think. Jordan recently wrote his case for becoming a liberal deficit hawk, and it made quite a few people mad. So I asked him to come talk about it on the show. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to bringing everyone from socialists to conservatives together to talk about the most important issues of the day. The Argument is against subtweeting. We state our opinions clearly, and we engage with our opponents directly. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Jordan, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So the bottom line of this article you wrote is that you're old.
Well, that's the meta point.
It's the meta point?
It's the meta point.
How old are you?
I'm 39.
It's not that old. You're going to offend like half the potential audience.
Look, when I was 25, a doctor told me I had the back of a 55-year-old.
So when you were 25?
When I was 25.
What kind of doctor?
Like a back doctor.
It's not a type of doctor. You're making up this story?
No.
I think
it was an orthopedist. I want to say. You know why I don't remember? Because I'm old and it was a long time ago. It's 14 years ago.
I'm not going to spring for the veracity of this story, but apparently 39 years old is old to Jordan. It's older than me, and that's all I need to know. But the actual other part of this article that you wrote is about the debt. And people have been trying to get me to care about the debt essentially my entire life, and I bet anyone who's watching this podcast right now, someone's been trying to get them to care about the debt their entire life too. And like, I'm not opposed, you know, in principle to caring about the debt, but I think that I have this sense that most people feel like it's such an abstract thing. They're like, okay, there's like some insane number, like I'm pulling up the Peter Peterson Foundation's like national debt clock, and right now it says 37,458,083,720. It just changed the middle of me reading that.
They sound like made up numbers.
It just like is not like, and this is like, it's $109,000 for every single person in America. Like, I'm not giving the government $109,000. I don't know anyone who's doing that.
Yeah.
Well, maybe hopefully billionaires are giving way more than that. But I think like the way I want to start is just like, what is the debt? Like, what is this number?
Okay. Start with the 101, which is there's the deficit and there's the debt. Right. And the deficit is the amount that we spend, the deficit is how much more we spend than we take in taxes every year. Right.
Okay.
Very simple. The debt is all, it's what it sounds like. It's all the treasury debt that's floating around there held by the public. It's what we owe. And it's what we have to pay interest on every month to bondholders. Right. That's an important distinction. People will yell at me on Twitter if I am not absolutely 100%
clear. You're just getting yelled at regardless.
Right, of all the things. If at any given moment I am not crystal clear about which of those two things I'm discussing at a given moment, someone will chime in.
Okay, so the deficit's like the government pays like trillions of dollars for like roads and for like healthcare and for the military spending, and then it takes in taxes, and then the difference between those two is the deficit. And then the debt is all of the deficits added up plus all of our interest that we owe?
Well, it's the interest is separate. We pay the interest on the debt, but the debt is just the stock, right?
Yeah.
The deficit is the flow and the debt is the stock of bonds that are sitting out there, all the treasury debt sitting on, you know, investors' books right now that you and I and China, you know, own right now.
Who owns it?
I have not looked at the breakdown recently, but I mean, a lot of it is foreign bondholders. A lot of it is just families, right? I mean, like, you know, I have a part of my 401k is in ETFs that contain treasury bonds, right? Like, you know, this doesn't factor into the debt we're worried about, but the Social Security Trust Fund actually holds a bunch of U.S. Treasury debt. That's what pays interest on it. So it's investors, it's foreign investors, it's, you know, people want American debt.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, it is valuable. It is essentially a global currency. And the reason for that is because people expect that we are going to pay it back. It is supposed to be, you know, God, you know, knock on wood, it's supposed to be the least risky asset in the world. It's the, you know, what they call the, you know, treasury yields, the risk-free rate of return. Mm-hmm. Because if Uncle Sam is not paying back his debt, the whole everything is falling apart.
But that just means this is a thing too. This is why whenever I hear this argument, then I just sort of check out, because basically the entire financial system rests, the entire global financial system rests on the fact that like we're not defaulting. Like China really doesn't want us to default. Like nobody really wants us to default, because it would fuck everyone to have this happen.
Yeah.
And so I guess like why isn't this just like the end of this podcast? Like why don't we just stop it now, 4 minutes in, and go like, all right, don't worry, no one wants it to happen.
Well, gradual. I mean, nope. Yeah, like no one wants to happen. Yeah. But like sometimes things happen that you don't want to.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I would say is this. First off, no one thinks we're defaulting tomorrow or the next year or the next 20 years. Like this is not a tomorrow problem.
We are recording this on September 18th. So folks, we can cancel Jordan if we did default.
The only time the idea of the U.S. defaulting becomes a real like live issue is around the time that we have to raise the debt ceiling, which you know I'm not going to dive into that right
now. No, you should.
Well, okay, so we do have this thing called the debt ceiling, where essentially there's only so much debt that the U.S. government is allowed to issue at a given time, and Congress has to pass a bill raising it.
Allowed by itself. Like we set the debt ceiling.
No other country does this. I mean, no other country does it the way we do it. As a result, we do have this we create these self-imposed crises. What we've seen every time there has been a people have to wonder, okay, is this the big one? Is this the time the U.S. just purposely decides it's not going to pay its bonds, even though it could? Mm-hmm. Because we have to issue new bonds in order to pay our old ones. That's where the issue comes into play. You know, every time we've had one of these showdowns in Congress, it's resolved itself. It does seem like pretty much everyone, with the exception of a handful of psychos. This is Capitol Hill, after all. It's never just a few weirdos. You know, most people realize that this is just not an option, that you need to come to sort of agreement on the debt ceiling. So, you know, excluding those some very weird political circumstances, nobody thinks that we are naturally going to default on our debt tomorrow. Nobody thinks that we are going to face rapid increases in what we have to pay on our debt tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I think we'll discuss that a little bit more. But what's worrisome is if over a long period of time, you know, over decades, the U.S. fiscal situation gets worse and worse and worse, and then it does start to look like we're not reliable. Do people start charging us more interest in order for us to borrow? Mm-hmm. Do they shift their reserve currency holdings to other assets? Like, after a while, does the U.S. look like less of a sure bet? Mm-hmm. And how does that affect us economically? And then do we get ourselves into a situation one day where we could end up in sort of, you know, stumbling into an infinite debt spiral? That's the absolute worst case scenario. And it would take a lot to get us there that I can talk about. But, you know, it's mathematically something that could happen on paper. So it's not as if, you know, anybody is sitting here saying, oh yeah, U.S. increased its debt to GDP ratio by X amount, they're screwed, you know, on Thursday. It's that long term, the prognosis is a little dicey, and it's the type of thing that, yeah, we should be thinking about how we're going to deal with, because I think this gets back to my being an ancient old man. I've been thinking, like, why have I actually started caring about this issue more recently?
Well, right? Before we get into that, I think that, like, I read this number that is, like, insanely large. I don't know. It's, like, $37 trillion or whatever. And, like, at every point in my life, it's been some insanely large number that I can't even fully grasp. And so, like, when you've mentioned this term debt to GDP ratio. And, like, that's the way that most people talk about, like, you know, how big the debt has gotten relative to the size of the American economy. And that's a good way of thinking about this problem, is like, how big is that number? Right now, what is that number? And also, when does it become too much? Like, what's the tipping point?
Right. So lots of that's a tricky question.
that's why we're here.
That's a deceptively complicated question. But I will give you an answer. So right now, you know, I want to step back again. It's like, why do we care about debt to GDP?
Yeah.
Right? Like, as opposed to just the number, like the 6 quadrillion or whatever the hell the debt is. It's because, I mean, like, it's sort of like a household or a corporation, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just knowing how much debt someone has doesn't really tell you much about their financial situation. I can tell you I owe $500,000. Mm-hmm. You don't know how much I make.
You're a billionaire.
Yeah.
Here's the argument. We pay writers $1 billion.
$1 billion. Sorry. No, we're not making that Barry Weiss kind of money. Sorry. We're not there yet.
Yeah.
One day.
Yeah. She'll get NBC. We'll get ABC. It'll be okay.
Yeah.
we're going to cut that out, right?
We're keeping that in. Yeah, okay. We'll save liberalism at that point. So you don't know how, if you have $500,000, maybe if you don't, if you make, you know, as $50,000 a year, you might be in some trouble. Mm-hmm. If you make $1 million a year, you're fine. You're golden. Right. So we think about the same way as the economy, how much debt you have compared to the size of the economy, because that should tell you roughly whether or not you can pay it. Right?
I also feel like people have weird heuristics around this. Adam Ozimek, who is a friend of the show, friend of the argument, has like a very funny bit about how Americans like borrow way too much for their personal vehicles. He's just like, I mean, when you really think about it, it's kind of crazy. Like the average student loan, last time I checked, is around $30,000 what people are borrowing. And people are like, this is a crisis. Like, this is really bad. And like, people are borrowing for like $100,000 cars, like casually, while earning like $80,000. Yeah. Like, I was like stressed out about buying a car that was like $17,000 when I was like coming out of college, and it was just like, no one else cares, like we're all just doing this. But anyway,
but Jerusalem,
yeah,
this is America. Like,
we need big ass truck abundance. That's what we need.
You need the $80,000 F-150. Like, that
no other way to live.
Literally no other way to live.
But okay, debt to GDP ratio.
So you need to think about it in relative terms, like, can you pay your debt? And that also, it's a good way to figure out just like how fast the debt's growing. So right now we're around 100%. Like, we're kind of creeping back up to like World War II levels, which gives you a sense of where
we were borrowing a lot then, huh?
Yeah. A lot compared to the economy. I like also to you know, for perspective, around the, but right before the Great Recession, way back before everything started going to hell in America.
the good old times, the 1920s, time. Yeah.
No, the Great, not the Depression, the Great Recession.
Okay.
Sorry.
I was like, what are you talking about?
No. We were alive at this point. It was like around, a little under 40%. Right, okay. So it's gone up quite a bit.
That's
and
bad.
Another way to think about it that tells you a little bit about like the expansion of the debt we've had. Probably the more important number is actually how much we're paying on the debt as a percentage of our economy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's back near historic highs, because we're paying like 3% of GDP a year in treasury payments.
What's like something equivalent to that? Like, what do we pay for that's like 3%?
I don't know. I should have looked that up. But what I can tell you is that it's kind of back near where we were in the early 90s when things weren't so great, because we had rising, and people don't think of it as like the early 90s as like, I guess people have forgotten that there was a lot of fear about the debt in the early 90s, but that's part of what, you know, powered Ross Perot's campaign, right? Like, there was a lot of concern before the era of the Clinton surpluses that we were running into fiscal trouble. And it was partly because we were coming off this period of high interest rates, and we borrowed a lot during Reagan's presidency, and suddenly our finances were looking a little janky. So we're kind of back there right now. What makes it worrisome, right, is a couple of things. One is that our demographics are getting really, really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is we're just getting old, right? We're getting
great replacement.
Yeah, no, it's we're replacing young people with old people. That's actually
it's
the great
called
replacement.
Aging.
Yeah, that's the great replacement that's really happening. Yeah, Forget this like Fox News conspiracy bullshit. Yeah. It's just like we're all yeah, me. I'm getting old. That's what's my, I think it's pretty obvious why that could be a problem for a country's finances. But just go over it. Like, one, it means we're going to be spending a lot more on Social Security, on Medicare, on old age entitlements. Two, it means you have fewer people working.
Yeah.
Right, to support them. You have fewer people paying taxes to support them. And so that just makes your fiscal situation progressively worse. So our budget problems, in a lot of ways, are aging problems.
Mm-hmm.
And they're population problems. So that's like the main thing that people are kind of worried about right now. You can project all that. You can do the actuarial calculations and figure out where we're going to be in 20 years. It's like, this doesn't look great. And so that's kind of what's different. It's like we have pretty high debt, historically speaking, and our trajectory is not good. Now, the first question you asked, right, before I went on that long, lovely rant, was when is there too much debt? When is high too high?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's there's a lot that goes into answering that. But the first thing I'll say is there's no magic number that we know of.
Yeah.
Right. We don't. And there and this is part of the problem.
It'd honestly be easier, right? If we knew that it was 40 trillion, we'd be like, all right, standard 40 trillion.
Yeah, exactly.
No problem.
That would be it. Yeah. Right. Like, and this is part of the problem with this conversation is that there have been times where people have tried to say, yeah, there's this magic number and we have to stay below it or, you know, calamity is going to unfold. And in the piece I wrote, I talked a little bit about a famous paper by Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart, two well-known economists that became kind of notorious in the Obama era because they tried to answer this question of, you know, when does economic growth slow down as a result of having too much debt? And what the paper found was that countries that go above 90% of debt to GDP seem to have slower growth, right? Mm-hmm. They found a correlation there. So if you're above the countries that are above this mark, they're not doing so great. Below it, they're okay. You know, people took that result and they treated it as this magic number, as a threshold, where it's like, okay, we're getting close to
90%.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. 90%, or we're on a track for 90%. And that just like wasn't what the paper said, right? So that was like the number one problem.
So what did it say? Like, what do you mean?
Well, it was
just a correlation.
It just found like countries at that point seemed to have slower growth, and there could be a lot of reasons. And one of them is just that, which we've seen, is like when you have a recession or you have slow growth, you tend to borrow more. Right. Maybe in our case, we did things like stimulus spending. Mm. We did that during COVID. We did that during the Great Recession because we were trying to dig our way out of it.
So the causality could go the other way.
Right, could go the other way. But the other problem is that, you know, if you're in a recession, it means that, you know, people are at work, tax revenues go down. So maybe you put on debt that way.
Yeah.
So again, it might be just correlation rather than causation. The other problem with that paper that people may remember is that there was an Excel spreadsheet error in it that drove the Excel spreadsheet error heard around the world. So
people, I actually find it crazy how often that happens. Like, there have been a lot of papers recently where it's just like a basic arithmetic error.
This is like the whole thing, and I'm going way off our topic, but let's get into it. Like, this is the whole thing with like peer review, because this paper was peer reviewed, is that they don't like, it was back in the day, they didn't like go into your code.
Yeah.
Like, that wasn't actually what peer review was. It was like, did you cite the right papers? Does this make basic sense? Now there's more of that where, you know, that some journals will actually try to make you like submit your code or whatnot so people can pore over it. But it's, it was, you know, some other bloggers like dug in and, you know, found, hey, there's an error here. So, you know, there's
econ bloggers, load bearing parts of the ecosystem.
They really, God bless us all. So there have been occasional attempts to say this amount of debt is too much. And it's kind of gone hand in hand with these outbreaks of hysteria we've seen over the years. Like, again, around the time of the euro crisis, everyone let's say we're going to be Greece.
Yeah.
Right. Like, whenever there's a country that's having problems with either debt or inflation, the U.S. is always on the verge of becoming that country. So it's, we're going to become Greece, or we're going to become Argentina, or whatever. The reality is, you know, what you basically want is something we think of as debt sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You want to be on a track that your debt isn't growing infinitely, that it stabilizes that it's growing manageably and it's going to stabilize somewhere so that it doesn't literally eat up your entire economy. Because that is what theoretically can happen.
Like, yeah.
If you do the spreadsheet, you can look at it, and if things go wrong, your debt can grow so large that your payments are larger than the economy, which that's bad, obviously. But if you want to make sure that it's on a manageable path, and this is, I hope we do a graphic or something here.
Yeah.
But there's a little inequality.
Imagine it's like floating.
Floating in the other. But the thing you want to keep in mind is that generally you want to make sure that your economy is growing faster than your interest rate, right? You may have heard this back, if those remember the big Thomas Piketty debates back in the day, Piketty debates, R is greater than G, right? Or R is equal to G.
Mm-hmm.
You want to make sure that R is less, the rate of interest.
What is R?
The rate of interest is less than growth.
Okay.
Right? And as long as that, like, as long as less than your economic growth rate, and as long as you can kind of manage that and keep it there, you're okay. Like, that's fine. That's like, that's the goal to shoot for. And that's really unsatisfying.
Yeah.
Like, when you talk to people about, when you really want to talk to people about debt, and you're like, well, because everyone wants to know, like, okay, like, what is the magic number? What do we shoot for? It's like, it's an inequality. It's a formula, right?
Yeah.
Like,
but I think it's also important to think about, like, there's so many factors that end up influencing it. So, like, you know, you've talked a little bit about the interest rate and our the debt GDP ratio, but also, like, the confidence that people have in American institutions writ large has a huge impact on this, right? Because a big part of the reason people invest in the United States, the reason why they say like, oh, you know, the Treasury is selling bonds, like I want to buy a share. That's basically saying I want to buy a share of the U.S. economy. Like that's what they're saying by doing that. But if they, for some weird reason, begin to believe that perhaps they don't want to buy shares in the U.S. economy, or that shares in other economies are more safe, or that in order to buy a share in the U.S. economy, they're going to need a little bit higher of a return for their money, like that can start increasing the burden, the debt burden that we feel, even if we're not borrowing more literally right then.
Right. And so this is we saw like a little preview of what a panic about the stability of the U.S. would look like when Donald Trump announced his tariffs in April, mm-hmm. the Liberation Day tariffs. And all of a sudden you were hearing about this thing called the Sell America trade, which was charming, especially if you got caught on the wrong side of that one. RIP, my brokerage account. But
you really are old. My yeah. God. Yes. Not my brokerage account. Okay.
Yeah. So what happened there was all of a sudden you saw stocks were going down, but also like treasury yields were shooting up, which meant treasury prices were falling. Mm-hmm. And that's not usually supposed to happen if people are worried about stock prices.
Wait, break that down for us.
Yeah, right. So usually when stock prices start falling because people are worried about the economy, people like then bond yields are supposed to fall because people are supposed to buy treasuries.
So like right? They're safer. If stocks feel scary, people go to buy bonds.
Because they're supposed to be safe.
Yes, right? But instead.
Instead people seemed like they were also selling off treasuries. So the idea was like people just didn't want to be part of the U.S. for a few days.
Yeah.
Like that was the sell America trade. Just like, unload it all.
Yeah.
They're like, okay, we're buying Euro bonds, whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean that is the fear that eventually if your country is enough of a shit show, mm-hmm. if we become enough of a shit show, that you would see that. And now that's eased up. The Sell America trade is off. Obviously, like the S&P 500 is at like new highs as we're recording this. You know, the bond market is stabilized. But we got a little peek. It's sort of also like in Great Britain, they had this under Liz Truss where mm-hmm. she unveiled that like just crackpot tax plan, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden the bond vigilantes came out and said nope. And like started selling.
Yeah.
So you know you want stability. Mm-hmm. that's kind of a necessary ingredient for all of this.
So I want to like make this more concrete for people. Yeah, like, sure. Let's say you're a regular person and the debt gets too high, whatever that threshold is. What does it actually mean for you? Like, I don't owe anyone anything. Like, the government as an entity owes bondholders, but like, I'm also a bondholder. Does it mean that maybe it's good for me? Like, what actually ends up happening?
Yeah, so there are a few things you have to worry about. And I, you know, the first thing, the classic issue that economists will turn to is something called crowding out. And what it means is that if your debt load gets too high, your economy might end up slowing down. Growth might slow. Why is that? Right. Well, if the U.S. government is issuing too much debt, interest rates might start to rise. Mm-hmm. Right. And the reason that, you know, it's not usually because everyone thinks the, you know, country is going to hell in a handbasket. It's not like the Trump situation. The classic explanation for that is that, well, if the government is trying to sell more bonds and they have to convince investors to buy them, those investors already have, you know, their money elsewhere. They already have it in assets that are returning a certain amount. So they have to if they offer a higher yield, a higher interest rate to get people to move their money.
Yeah.
And so eventually you're just like the more debt you issue, the higher interest rates are going to go. What that does is it raises interest rates overall and it makes it more expensive to invest.
Yeah.
Right? It makes it more expensive to get a mortgage, to invest in a new office or for mm-hmm. a company to take out debt in order to, you know, get a business started or to, you know, buy whatever, new AI
loans, mortgages, car loans.
Yeah, exactly. Like all that stuff slows down. So the economy slows down. That's the idea. The higher your interest rates are, the more, you know, more cools off the economy. And that is a long-term problem. It lowers investment, and the less investment you have, it also means that, you know, you get less productive effort, yada, yada, yada.
But also jobs, right?
Yeah, jobs. I mean, so that's one of the concerns that, you know, if our debt rises too far, eventually we're going to start feeling the pinch from that. The other thing, the real like worst case scenario is this like fiscal crisis, this financial crisis, and that's the situation where eventually people see that you're on this bad trajectory, or they lose faith in you as like the government. Mm-hmm. Something happens, and they decide they don't want to own U.S. debt anymore.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden you just see the selling pressure, so all of a sudden like our interest rates go way the heck up, or there's just a fire sale on U.S. assets. That's one way. Or you end up in this situation where, again, like on paper, if depending on what your growth rates are and what your how much interest you're paying, that you could get on this path to your debt stacking up infinitely, mm-hmm. right? And that's that again, that's something that'd be way off. But again, if people see that's like on the horizon, that could then cause investors to say, oh, okay, we need to get out now.
Yeah.
Like, okay, if in 10 years this is going to happen, if in 20 years this is going to happen, I still don't want it. Like, we sell 30-year bonds,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So, like, if they see a problem coming in 30 years, they're going to say, no.
Yeah.
Like, we're not going to buy that bond. Or we're going to ask for higher interest rates. So it's those two things. It's slower economic growth, and it's the potential for, you know, actual crisis.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, but the thing for, like, regular people here to think about is that if we got to, like, an infinite debt spiral situation, it could mean, like, massive cuts to Social Security. It could mean massive cuts to other kinds of government investments because you're kind of, like, in a bad place. You know?
You're in the bad place.
Yeah.
No. I mean, yes, if, say, you were facing an immediate fiscal crisis or financial crisis, mm-hmm. like, we really did get to that absolute worst case scenario, there are only a few things you can do. One is you can just massively cut your government spending, which is that sort. You're just going to have to say goodbye to the safety net. You can try to inflate your way out of it, just print money, which that's not good.
People love inflation. Yeah,
you can try to inflate your way out of it. Yeah. You can just default, which is sort of the Argentina method,
yeah.
right? Like they've patented that one.
And it's good times, Argentina.
Good times. Yeah. Everyone wants to be Argentina. Yeah. Who amongst us doesn't want to be an Argentine? No, love their mountains, love their steak, don't love their history of fiscal of financial crises. But I think, you know, even dialing it back a bit, right? Like if it ever looked like we were really in trouble, like we were heading down that path, mm-hmm. like, it creates political pressure. We can talk more about the politics of all this later, yeah. but it creates a lot of political pressure for cuts or to do something. And mm-hmm. you know, the question is, are you going to raise taxes or are you going to cut benefits? And so I think the worse this situation gets, the more of a chance that eventually the U.S., like you, the more of a chance that Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid are going to be toast, right? Like,
yeah.
it's just like that's you're increasing the risk. And this is really all about, in a sense, risk management. But you know, I want to talk about kind of go back to the my being old part for a second.
Okay.
Right. And I've been dwelling on why it is that actually I found myself caring more about this issue recently, because for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, this is the, is Jordan a hypocrite part of the, part of the podcast. All of our right-wing listeners are like, all right, we've been talking about this shit for ages.
Right. Like, so for most of my like early career, I was very like dovish on the deficit and the debt. And there were like very good reasons for that.
Yeah.
Right. During the Obama era, there was, you know, we were in this deep recession and then basically a depression afterwards. Like there was just a long, slow recovery mm-hmm. Where the economy was awful.
Yeah.
Like, it was just awful. And essentially, as soon as we passed a stimulus bill, which was too small, the entirety of Washington, D.C. turned to deficit reduction and debt reduction. And they were like, okay, now that we've done this, we need to worry about debt. And it was like this hysteria that took over. And so everyone who was kind of young and like wanted a job, who had any experience of unemployment, it was kind of offensive in a way. It's like, we need to take care of the fire that's still kind of burning.
Yeah. There's still a problem with insufficient stimulus to make sure that people can actually, government, the businesses can start hiring again so people can have jobs. And now all of a sudden people are like, well, let's cut spending.
So you had these like blue ribbon commissions like Bull Simpson about how we were going to deal with the deficit. Partly is driven by the Tea Party, which mm-hmm. they all came and said, oh, we have to worry about the debt. And it was just maddening. And you heard all these horrible arguments at the time, like we're going to be Greece, like, mm-hmm. you know, we're about to hit the magic 90% threshold, that were just, it was all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the time, like, yeah, you should have been paying attention. Like, this was not the issue to be worrying about. We should have been worried about getting the economy back to full
and our
employment.
Interest rates were low.
Our interest rates were low. There was this idea that people thought, oh, well, you know, the inflation is going to come back because of all this spending, because of all this Federal Reserve stimulus.
It didn't.
It did not.
No.
reader, it did not. Interest rates were very low.
You can say reader. Viewer.
You can tell I'm just pure text. Like, that's is my natural environment. So, yeah, for a long time, this was just, like, not an issue that I worried a lot about.
Yeah.
A few things have changed, right, just factually on the ground. One is that our fiscal situation has gotten worse.
Yeah.
Especially with the Trump tax cuts, which are now kind of cemented in place.
Mm-hmm.
you know, we are, you know, our demographic situation also, which I said demographics are part of this, probably getting worse now, mm-hmm. thanks to Donald Trump's attacks on immigration.
But we just let in like 5 trillion immigrants, right? So isn't it fine?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the correct number,
quadrillion.
Right?
Yeah, we're just doing big. Every big number is a quadrillion.
Whatever.
There's probably
fake study that like people can't understand numbers larger than a million. So
I think that's
you can just start
exactly,
saying
just
stuff.
Say whatever. No, we had a historic immigration wave, but now also Donald Trump has cracked down so hard that we're looking at potentially a shrinking population this year. It's possible. And in the coming years. I mean, like, so that's like moving up the date that we're going to have problems. We are kind of doing all the wrong things right now and all the things to exacerbate these issues. And at the same time, and this is part of what really worries me, it feels like Republicans have kind of won this war on tax, are winning the messaging war on taxes.
Yeah.
They are convincing people, like, you know, if you look at the number of Americans who say taxes are too high, it's essentially spiked ever since the pandemic.
Yeah.
And part of that's probably people just feel pinched from inflation. Mm-hmm. But in general, they don't want to pay more. And so to me, it says like, if all the trends are going in the direction that if we run into trouble, the safety net is what's going to get hit. That's if we're going to be running into trouble sooner than we previously were, or it seems like it. And the safety net is the thing that's going to be in danger. So that's what the wonk in me is, mm-hmm. I think, where this concern is coming from. Like just but the old man in me, I think really what it is that, you know, we always talk about these issues. It's like, okay, well, 20 years from now, we have a problem. 30 years from now. Well, I now actually remember 20 years ago pretty well. I think that's it. Like, that was when I was in college. Like, I remember being 19.
Yeah.
Like, I remember what I was up to. I remember, like
that's now a real time scale for you.
Right. That's like 20 years from now, there is not a totally abstract number like it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, thinking forward, it's like, I've got 2 kids. 20 years from now, they're going to be in, they'll be coming at it, or they'll be in college or just leaving it, hopefully.
There won't be college.
If there are colleges.
There's no college.
If there are colleges, they will. I got, you know, again, knock on wood. But so to me, I think this actually is part of why people who are a little bit older tend to start fixating on this issue.
Yeah.
Like that's my like armchair anthropologist
take. I think you're actually making too much of the, I mean, it's a great bit and I'm glad that we're doing it for the audience here. But I think at a fundamental level, the facts on the ground changed significantly. It's not just the demographic stuff, which of course, like, we could have like seen coming, and you know, there's a lot of things you can do to make the demographics better if we like actually wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. We'll get into that with immigration. But it's just like interest rates, long-term rates went up.
Yeah.
Like that was the big problem. And we'll put that graph up for you guys to see. It's from Jordan's great article on our website. But it's just like, if that is a situation you're facing where like not like you are going to have higher and higher repayments, even on the same principle, like that is the dangerous situation. And like what we see, and like I'm literally gonna pull it up so I can look at it right now, but like you can see like from the like time period where Jordan was, you know, in college from 2000 to like even like up until like 2020, interest rates were low. It was not a big deal. And now they're spiked up. So now we're scared. And like, that seems reasonable. We don't actually know your track record of what you would have said in the 1990 spike that we see on this graph. So you avoided hypocrisy for
not
being alive.
I'm not John Chadle.
Yeah, you're not. Yeah.
It's like
we're just throwing strays at John Chadle for no reason.
No, it's a
friend of the show.
Friend of the show. That's
sorry, John.
It's true. Facts have changed on the ground. I'll say, like, you know, there, just to reemphasize how complicated all of this is, some of those high interest rates we're paying right now might not be permanent, right?
Yeah.
It's like cyclical factors. It's like, oh, there are a lot of inflationary pressures right now. And so the Fed has to have high short-term rates, which lead to higher long-term rates. But if all of a sudden we do something about inflation, maybe those rates will go down a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question is, like, how much is our debt adding permanently to what we have to pay on the debt?
Yeah.
Or sorry, that was a really great articulation. How much is the fact that we have a ton of debt adding to our interest rates permanently? Right?
Yeah.
Like, and that's harder to answer. I think what we're going to see, we're going to find out a little bit about that in the coming months, as like, because the Federal Reserve has started cutting rates, mm-hmm. started cutting short-term rates. I don't want to bore people, but like, if they start doing that, they start mm-hmm. cutting rates a bunch, and like the government's long-term rates stay kind of weirdly high.
Yeah.
Like what? Like the 10-year Treasury rate doesn't go down as much as you would expect it to. That might signal that we have a little bit more of a problem than we used to. That's like a thing to look out for right
okay.
now. So like, like key to, for like viewers to keep an eye or listeners to keep an eye on if they're like really obsessed with this?
Well, here at The Argument, one of our big vibes is not just dooming. So we want to like talk about like what you can actually do about this problem, because like I think that the one of the big issues that gets a lot of folks, particularly people who care about social security, care about the social welfare net, is that whenever they hear someone talking about the deficit or hear someone talking, they assume that what you're about to say is we need to make it impossible for you to get your basic social benefits. We need to cut food stamps, we need to cut health care, and like me and you care a lot about those programs and we want to see them expanded, we don't want to see them cut, but we're also like there's a real problem happening here. And so like your article is titled like, you know, how, you know, you're a liberal becoming a deficit hawk, and I want to talk through some of the solutions here that I think that we can actually have. So we're gonna doom some more.
No, I don't want to doom
more.
I want to talk about like a little bit more about the politics,
okay,
right, before we get to the solutions, right?
Okay,
because there's, I feel like one flows from the other. I like, so
Jordan
I'm
is directing
interrupt.
The pod.
I know.
Let's go. No, do
I am. I am the host now. Look at me. I am.
I'm the host. You've taken over. Okay, go. Go.
Yeah.
Go
anyway,
the politics of this are bad.
No, they're not. Well, so okay, the politics right now aren't great. But so one of the reasons I wrote this article is I do feel like that if you talk about the deficit, it automatically codes as sort of conservative or someone who wants to cut the safety net.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I think there's been this strain among certain progressives in recent years because of that to totally act like the deficit or and the debt are not a problem.
Yeah.
Right. I can rant and rave about modern monetary theory and those.
Should we have that, like a little segment for you to do
that? Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. But like, you know, I'll leave it at that for, you know, up until our big inflation spike, there was a fad for talking about how, oh, the debt is a fake problem.
Yeah.
We can spend as long as the government prints its own money, we can never have a debt crisis and yada, yada, yada. There was like this kind of strain within the left that like you didn't really ever have to worry about the debt. And one person who never really seemed to buy into that was Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie Sanders was actually always very, very good about being plain that, yes, all of his plans would involve taxing somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it was billionaires or with healthcare, he would be pretty upfront saying, yeah, you're going to have to pay higher taxes, but you're going to get free healthcare in response. He was always sort of a traditionalist on this stuff, but I think there is, at least within part of the left, there was a little bit of magical thinking about whether or not the debt was ever a problem. And it was a little bit of motivated reasoning too, because it did code as this issue where, you know, people obsessed about because they really just wanted to cut Social Security.
Yeah.
I don't think that needs to be the case.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, there is a way to be a liberal deficit hawk where you try to focus on solutions that very much match your values.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of them is making rich people, but also Americans in general, pay their taxes.
Mm-hmm.
We are not a normal country when it comes to taxes. It's like I know it doesn't feel like it, but we are actually undertaxed.
Let the hate comments roll in.
I wrote it down on this little piece.
You're getting canceled now, buddy.
I want to say, let's see if I get this right off the top of my head. I think we are like 30, like out of like the 37 members of the OECD, which is sort of developed or mostly developed countries, we have the 32nd lowest tax revenue to GDP ratio.
Mm-hmm.
So we collect the 32nd lowest amount, in terms of amount of taxes we collect as a share of our economy, right?
Yeah.
We're number 32 on the list out of 37. Let me double, or you know, no, sorry, I got that wrong. 32 out of 38.
Okay.
It's like, you know, I think if you take all of our healthcare spending, right, like all of our private insurance spending, and treat that as taxes, because in other countries that's how they handle it, we would go up to like 31 on the list, maybe 30th. Like we have, it's all taxes, we're including state, local, everything. It's like we do not pay much, and if we were a slightly more normal country, like I think you know conservatives love Hungary, right? Like they love Hungary right
some
now.
Some of them.
They love Viktor Orban right now.
I want to stand up for our conservative friends who hate Viktor Orban.
Yeah, sorry. Like J.D. Vance.
J.D. Vance loves Orban, for sure.
Like,
yeah,
they love Hungary. If we had Hungary's tax rates, we like would not have a deficit. right? Like, okay, cool. Let's take that. Instead of like the cracking down on press freedom, how about we borrow their tax rates? That'd be great.
I think this is a place to pause because I think that a lot of people's intuitions around this are going to be like pretty scrambled and I think that this actually shows up. You mentioned this earlier, but you have polling that you cite in the article that you wrote for The Argument, which if you don't already subscribe on our Substack. But they basically, since like 1955 or something, Gallup has been asking people, is the amount you pay in taxes about right, too high, or too low? The line for too low is like almost non-existent. They don't even show it. It's like max like 4% of people, and I'm like, that's an error. They didn't mean to put that in there. But around like 2019, you see the too high number skyrocket. Around 2020, you see the too high number skyrocket, and about right goes down. Before then, in 2019, actually, about right was above too high, and there have been. For most of this graph's history, people think it's too high. It's not like a situation where like there's a golden era where people are like excited to pay a lot more taxes or are fine with taxation. But I think what this indicates to me, and I mean, you put this in your article too, is just that like when people are talking, because there wasn't a massive tax hike in 2020 that would explain why you would see this massive spike in people being upset about their taxes. People, when they're asked this question about their taxes, and I think even right now our listeners and our viewers, when they're thinking about their tax burden, they're thinking their overall burden that they're facing on necessary costs, like whether that has to do with, you know, their property tax bill going up because their house has appreciated in value, or if it's about their price of groceries going up. All of these things contribute to the idea that like actually the amount of you pay in taxes is too high because the amount you're paying for everything is too high. So you need to like lower that number. And so I think this actually presents a really interesting puzzle for us. Like I think that like one big thing that a lot of social democrats have been pushing for a long time is like, how do you get people more invested in wanting to pay their taxes, seeing the value in doing that, getting actually value out of that? And a big part of that, I think, is actually lowering costs where we can, like being very serious about that.
Yeah, I think it's part of it is just making sure people can afford their lifestyle, right?
Like housing, healthcare.
This is another like stat there. Like, you know, a lot of ways Americans are wealthier than ever, right? Like if you look at like the share of families that like make over $150,000 a year, it's over a third of the country now. It's almost doubled since the late 90s.
I mean, my favorite indicator is how many articles has The Cut written about $300,000 householders struggling to make their bills.
But that's it, right? No. But like even like fairly, America's become fairly affluent.
Yes.
And like, but people still feel pressed. And so like part of it, I agree, is dealing with things like the cost of housing and childcare. I think there's this other factor, which is like making sure that like people have a concrete sense of what their money's going to. One thing that, you know, one big fight that's coming up soon is how do we fund Social Security, because the trust fund is actually depleting. Like that's kind of an artificial problem. Technically, we could just like kick that can down the, you know, road and fund it with just like general tax revenue. But it has a trust fund, and if that depletes and we don't replace it with something, there's an automatic like 23% cut to benefits. So that's coming up in the early 2030s.
And that's like the biggest source of wealth for the average American is their Social Security, or so for the average senior.
It's a massive part of it. I actually don't know off the top of my head, but it's a big chunk of the average senior's income. And so, you know, we're gonna have to decide what to do there. There's gonna be some kind of fight, and maybe Congress kicks the can. But I think, you know, I would like to be in a place where Democrats can say, let's raise payroll taxes a little bit and just fund this. Like, yeah, we're gonna pay for Social Security. And have that not be totally. There's currently a cap on how much of your income is subject to payroll taxes. It's like $172,000 a year right now.
Yeah.
Everything above that doesn't get the Social Security payroll tax.
So, like people who are making like $500,000, like the last half of their income is like not subject to payroll taxes.
There are a lot of corporate lawyers out there who are not subject to any of it. You know, a lot of coders, a lot of Google engineers.
Not anymore.
That's true. Yeah.
Leave the coders alone.
Yeah, yeah. AI is wiping them out. Yeah, but, not all coders. You know, I would like to be in a position politically as a country where we can have a serious conversation about raising payroll taxes to just fund our old age pensions. Like, if we can't do that, I think we're in a lot of trouble.
Doing that is really like, I mean, I don't know. Like, I have a lot of empathy for the fact that people are just like, okay, rent has gone up. yeah. in my area. In order for me to get access to good jobs, I need to like live in a shoebox apartment. I can't have kids, as many kids as I want to, because daycare costs are too high. And now you're saying for me to pay for someone else's Social Security, like, I need to raise the taxes I'm paying. And like, to me, like, I agree with you that like there is like, I mean, just the numbers you're laying out here, like, obviously we do pay less than other countries do, but just like, there's something to be said about like building a tax positivity movement resting on taking affordability issues seriously at the beginning.
I agree. I think it's like, yeah. you just need to be clear. I think it's a combination of kind of emphasizing, it's addressing affordability, because obviously people are just not even going to want to hear you if they feel yeah. too pressed. Like, that's, if inflation is bad, no one's going to want to listen to like, inflation, affordability are slightly separate things. But if costs are feel out of control, no one's going to even want to have a conversation about raising taxes.
Yeah.
I think that's number one. Number two, it's making sure people understand what their tax dollars are going to.
Yeah.
And number three, I think they're and this is where like the idea of a tax positivity movement, like kind of a grassroots thing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel so nerdy saying it. It's probably never going
to
happen.
We have to tag James Medlock, anonymous Twitter account.
He's done more than anyone to try and make it happen. But like, there needs to be a sense that like paying your taxes is patriotic, mm-hmm. right? That like, and I kind of fear that we're becoming the opposite, that like we're losing all, like in the Trump era, we're losing all sense of patriotism and everyone's just out for their own scam. We're becoming kind of like a nation of small time grifters, but like everyone's trying to do their own hustle.
Yeah.
But like, I do think there needs to be some attempt to make the idea of paying your taxes feel like patriotic duty.
Yeah.
That's part of it. It's like, I think trying to make us a country that's a little bit more normal on taxes is half of it. I also think that if you're a liberal and you're worried about the deficit, right? Mm-hmm. Part of it is demographics,
mm-hmm.
right? And there are two ways you can fix your demographics, your age problem. One is you can have more immigration, or two is you can have more babies.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. It's simple. There isn't like some secret option C. Mm-hmm. Like, and if there is, like, you know, I get
print more babies.
The other option is like robots, right? Like, you can have
that's
like,
true.
If like AI has like totally revolutionizes the economy, and maybe we don't have to, when we enter the singularity,
yeah,
we maybe don't have to worry about any of this.
Yeah, we have other problems.
Yeah, we have, exactly. Skynet is like yeah. a much more.
Kelsey Piper has a story today about the problems of AI.
Yeah, if I'm like, it's gonna be, I'm gonna be sitting there and be like worrying about the deficit as like it terminated.
Yeah,
barring that,
mm-hmm.
right? It's babies or it's immigration.
Yeah.
And
babies take time, though.
Babies take time.
You can't just make a baby right
also,
away.
Also, we don't really know exactly how to get people to have more babies. Like, there's.
I actually have an alternative about this. I actually think people are making this way more complicated than it needs to be. I think right now, if I said, Jordan, I will pay you $5 million to have another child.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, but we're all complicated. It's like, we're not even close. Like, I sometimes like to compare the amount we spend on Social Security, which is how much we spend on old people, yeah. to how much we spend on young people. It's like, not even close. I think if we spent Social Security levels on young people, we'd probably have a sustainable population.
I think you would be closer to it. I agree. Speaking of magic numbers, yeah. I really don't know what it is.
I just think most people have some. Yeah. If you want to have kids, if you yeah. don't, obviously, like, you're not going to be. I mean, maybe there's some number that move you, but like, that's kind of also like weird and coercive. But like, if you wanted to have kids, but you feel like, oh man, like, you know, I need a house. I want to be able to go on vacation. I also want to be able to visit my family sometimes. Like, I would need a couple hundred extra $1,000 to make this work. Like, that's like. That's doable, like, for the federal government to do. But obviously, we're on a conversation about the deficit.
Yeah, so exactly. So
massive right. trillion-dollar
so
outlay.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's like, that's a big investment that pays off in 20 years, maybe. Yeah. And so, maybe.
You got to get them working young. Yeah. Repeal those child labor laws.
There you yeah. go. There,
get that to, was a joke.
Into the,
I was not serious.
Hey, kid, you like Minecraft, right? Get down
Roblox.
There.
You like Roblox? Time to do a gardening outside.
Get in there.
Yeah.
Go down.
Okay.
Trump,
but like,
Trump wants you getting that coal. So to me, it's like, okay, we don't exactly know how to you know, get birth rates back up. The other thing we can do is immigration. And
yeah.
I think what that means is we're going to need higher immigration, certainly higher immigration than what Trump wants.
Yeah.
There's
also not a magic number there either, right, too.
Well,
yeah, yeah.
This is a project I want to work on.
This is now a pitch session.
Yeah, it's a pitch session.
Yeah.
This is something I want to talk to demographers about, because I think you actually could try to figure out a magic number based on like what your goal is.
Love that. Okay.
But
that seems true. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you could be like, okay, if I want to keep like the workforce at like X size, like how many?
Especially because we already have the CBO projections telling us
right,
how
could,
much
you
we're
could
seeing.
Do it. Yeah, I haven't really seen a lot of people try to come up with it, but like, nonetheless, like, just directionally,
yeah.
like, immigration more, yeah. is going to help you here. And some people argue, it's like, well, some immigrants can, like, they contribute more than others. Some yeah. are a cost. Some, leave all that aside. Like, in general, yeah. like, if you have more people moving to your country and working, that at the very least, it puts off your doomsday date
yeah.
for the debt. And so I think that, yeah, like, if you're a liberal, if you're a liberal deficit hawk, part of it needs to be about having a immigration policy that serves the economy.
Yeah.
Right?
So yeah.
It's not about, you know, a return to, you know, I've joked in an article about how openish borders kind of worked out okay under Biden. Like, I don't actually want open borders, just for anyone who's been yelling at me about
coward.
That too.
Coward.
But it is about, like, returning to a, it's about finding an immigration level that can, like, create a stable long-term, or that helps mm-hmm. the economy and creates a stable long-term fiscal situation. And so I think, like, those are two things to really focus on. And then, you know, as far as, like, cutting programs, cutting our spending, there are places where, yeah, we do need to, like, we should just be shaving money. Like, there are obvious places that everyone kind of agrees in Washington that, like, there's a lot of waste. Like, Medicare Advantage is a problem.
Yeah.
Like we overpay all those private insurers in that program, and there would be ways to make Medicare more stable if mm-hmm. we, like, and reduce premiums for everybody, by the way, if we dealt with some of that spending. But, like, I don't think liberals should be walking into this conversation being like, oh, by the way, I also, here are all the cuts I want to do.
Yeah.
Like, which was kind of the attitude under Obama.
Yeah.
That was like, we're going to, like, pre-negotiate.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, here are the things that we want and they can, like, we, here, I think there are things that we value that we know will help the debt and the deficit
mm-hmm.
and that will make us a stronger country fiscally, and we should push for those.
Yeah.
And we should think about, and they're not easy, right? And in a sense, I think it's also, it underscores why we can't give up on those things,
mm-hmm.
right? That's part of my concern here, is that, like, okay, well, Democrats are going to kind of give up on immigration.
So
they're
going to
give up on taxes.
I want to pretend to inhabit the body of a conservative wonk right now, like,
yeah,
maybe
sure.
a center-right wonk, maybe, you know, I'm gonna embody Alan Cole or something right now.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna say a couple things. So first
Go
one is, you're being delusional about not having to cut entitlement programs in order to solve this problem. Like, yes, like, it is true that in a theoretical world we could, like, let in the appropriate amount of immigrants and that would, like, help us out and, like, that would kick the doomsday clock down the road a little bit or whatever. But just, like, if you're, like, seriously worried about, like, the tail risk of, like, a debt spiral, mm-hmm. then you should be more serious about reducing entitlements, including raising the retirement age, reducing the benefits that people get in certain levels, at certain income levels for Social Security or food stamps or other these larger healthcare outlays, instead of which I know you support, actually expanding healthcare, expanding universal healthcare and these options. So I think for a lot of conservatives listening, they're like, okay, fine, finally some liberals who are paying attention to this problem, but even they have, like, this trade-off denialism around the amount of money that we're spending on entitlement programs.
I think they're, like, if I were a politician,
yeah,
sitting down at, like, the negotiating table, actually trying to craft a bill,
yeah,
I would say here's what I want, and
yeah.
here is what you want,
mm-hmm.
right? Again, like, I think that, like, let me take that back. Let me restart. I think
so you're not a politician.
No, I'm not a politician.
No reason to do it.
Let me restart this. Let me say. I think that it's, if you were to actually negotiate a deal,
yeah,
right, to deal Social Security in 2033,
mm-hmm.
more likely than not, you're going to have some combination of not immediate benefit cuts,
mm-hmm.
but slowing program growth, because mm-hmm. like, Republicans are going to demand that in return for any kind of tax hikes.
Yeah.
So there's a discussion to be had about that. And it's all math. Like, yeah, you can do it in any sort of way. It's like, if you say, like, this is, like, but if we're talking about, like, in general, just principles,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say, yeah, I want to cut Social Security. I'm going to say, okay, here are the things I want to do that will help with this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Here are the things that comport with my values that mm-hmm. will deal with the debt. Here, this is what I'm bringing to the table. And now if you, on the other side of it, want to say, actually, no, we have to cut benefits, okay, we can negotiate over that.
Yeah.
But it's, there's no, I mean, I can put together a model where we save it with tax hikes.
Yeah.
You can,
well,
do it on
the way
paper.
That I think that the response that, like, you know, a conservative wonk would have is
yeah.
that, like, well, raising these tax hikes could also slow growth.
It could, to some extent.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, tax hikes at some point can slow growth. At the same time, like, there are probably some fairly efficient ones or a lot of really like
carbon tax. Let's go.
No, but they're also just like the Trump tax cuts are so, like the Trump's like Alan Cole, Alan, yeah. Shout out. Like he'll tell you that the most recent tax cuts have a lot of fat in them that yeah. like are not economically useful. Right. Yeah. Like there are giveaways to, you know, a lot of business owners get some really, I'm like getting mad thinking about some of these things.
Let me tell you about
1099A, like there are 199A. It's just like, no, it's not. But like, there are a lot of low value tax cuts in that package, and these have been made permanent. So like, there are taxes that we could raise that would not slow growth that much. There are also, and part of the idea here is that yes, you do things that might slow growth on one side, mm-hmm. and like, I think we should be careful about growth is very important if we wanted to manage our debt. But you also do things like encourage immigration and encourage high skill immigration and also spend on things like science and research that increase productivity, mm-hmm. that improve growth. It's a balance,
yeah.
right? You do the thing, you can do more than one thing and you can-
You do liberalism,
yeah. right? So I don't like-
Okay, so now I'm gonna embody a different kind of conservative, which is a Trump conservative.
Yeah.
I don't know if we call those conservatives, Trump reactionaries, whatever they're called. I know that you and I are against the tariff policies currently being enacted by this administration. Yeah. But I looked up before this episode the projections for how much the tariffs are going to bring in. And it's about, you know, it's not nothing. It's about $2.3 billion over 10 years currently right now, not including what else might kick in.
It's a
significant amount of tax increase and that they're bringing in. And you know, tariffs are a tax. They're a tax on foreign imports. And isn't this a good way to help reduce the deficit?
No, it's not a good way to do it. It's a way.
You could also just forcibly import people who don't want to live here. No, that's another way.
Jesus Christ.
You could ban abortion. There's another way.
No, so it's like the tariffs are supposed to raise a bunch of revenue, right?
Yes.
If they stay in place. But they're just like they're a bad tax. That's the thing about tariffs isn't, the problem isn't that they're a tax. It's that they're like they're a really distortive tax.
Yeah.
Like they just like mess with your supply chain. They make it hard to do some kinds of business, but not others. They support really inefficient businesses. They're all sort of, they create winners and losers. They give Tim Cook the ability to like ask for exemptions from, from Donald Trump. Like that. So
also as an individual had for the first time to pay an import duty on my wedding dress. I'm personally very mad about this.
Exactly. That's exactly. They make Jerusalem angry.
They don't make American wedding dresses. It's not my fault.
if they make Jerusalem angry, they make me angry.
Yeah, there we go.
Because I'm a good employee that way. But no, so like, you know, if you're gonna talk about, okay, let's have a consumption tax, it's like, okay, we should have a VAT then. Like if that's what you, okay, like you want to raise revenue off of taxing the stuff people buy, then do a VAT. Like the value added tax, which is what the rest of the world does.
Yeah.
Like we could have a small VAT.
Okay, what's your favorite tax?
My favorite tax is the income tax.
Okay, I think mine's carbon.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with carbon.
Really?
That feels exciting to me.
I like the income tax just for like, it's...
I just wanted the novelty of saying that.
No, it's the equalizer. The income tax, historically, it's a thing that deals with... It's redistributive.
I'm not going to stand by my answer, but I just wanted to say carbon tax.
Yeah.
I had to bring that in here because we talked about
carbon tax
time.
That's the one where
everyone's such a hate. You know what we could do? Carbon tariff.
I'm a big fan of carbon
tariffs.
I thought about that one. Like, you just change the Trump tariffs into carbon tariffs.
Yes, and then you can solve the problem.
Except the problem is, like, every other country is...
Carbon tariffs to us. They're already doing that.
What happens when every other country is lower emissions? Like, what happens when China, like, just has the green revolution?
You know what? Shh.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been a great conversation. So now is our time for our last and final question, which is, you're already heated.
Yeah.
Which is good. That's where you need to be. So it's called the argument for a reason. So what is an argument you've come across recently that just pissed you off? Usually this is like a question when someone's like gotten, you know, they've gotten into the groove. They're like, calm down. But you're already at like 10.
No, I'm
you know
already
what I mean?
At 10. Yeah. The lights are hot. Like it's just.
Lights? Yeah. We're just in my living room.
Oh, yeah.
What are you talking about? What lights? This is how we look.
What's that?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. If you can't tell from the glisten on my forehead. No. So this morning, everyone's been talking about the Jimmy Kimmel situation.
Mm-hmm.
And
we'll remind people because it's
going to be. Yeah, I was going to say, so this, everyone, we're recording this in the wake of ABC indefinitely suspending Jimmy Kimmel. And pretty much everyone And the Democratic Party is freaking out about this as assault on, rightfully freaking out. I'm freaking out about this as an assault on free speech because he was suspended over comments he made about Charlie Kirk's assassination. And it happened immediately, pretty much immediately after the head of Trump's head of the FCC went on a podcast and said that he was going to start threatening their network affiliates' broadcast licenses.
Let's play that clip, actually, for people so they can remember it.
Frankly, when you see stuff like this, I mean, look, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. These companies can find ways to change conduct, to take action, frankly, on Kimmel, or, you know, there's going to be additional work for the FCC ahead. Obviously, look, there's calls for Kimmel to be fired. I think, you know, you could certainly see a path forward for suspension over this.
So it happened immediately, right? It just like, you know, this is a pretty... Late night hosts have been fired before.
They have
they've been let go for impolitic things they've said. Bill Maher got fired in the early 2000s for making a joke about 9/11, or not making a joke. Actually, he wasn't making a joke. He argued that the 9/11 hijackers were brave because they, you know, they gave their lives for their cause, for better or worse. And he lost his show over that. It was called Politically Incorrect. But like
it's actually, I forgot about that. That's so crazy. Right. So, said that.
These things have happened before, except what the issue here is the direct involvement of the federal government. Even if they didn't actually go forward and try to take away licenses, it's pretty clear.
There's a clear threat.
The muscle, right?
And so, also, there's reporting. I think Rolling Stone had reporting that showed that there were executives within Disney or ABC or something that said that they did not think that Kimmel had said anything that bad.
Yeah,
and but they were afraid of Trump retaliation. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And so today, this morning, there's a conservative wonk named Vic Roy. I think it's healthcare mostly. Mm-hmm. He chimed in and was like, hey, it was just last year that the Supreme Court said it was fine when the Biden administration pressured Facebook to censor material related to COVID, right? This is a very, very bad argument. The idea is that somehow the Biden administration equally was threatening Facebook the way Trump was just threatening ABC and its affiliates.
Yeah.
And so that was an infringement on free speech that the court said was okay. So how is that any different than this? Everyone should calm down.
Yeah.
And these are not equivalent things whatsoever if you actually look at the situation. And just to remind I thought in the back of my head, I was like, I don't remember the Biden administration threatening to pull the plug on Facebook somehow if it didn't change, if it didn't change its algorithm or moderate COVID content better. And so I went back and actually looked at that Supreme Court decision because there was a dissent in it from Samuel Alito where he said actually what the government was doing should have been, unconstitutional. It was awful, yada, yada, yada. And he explained what he laid out, like the worst of how the government's pressure campaign. And the closest thing to actual government retaliation that the Biden administration ever threatened was going out in public and saying, we think Facebook is being irresponsible here, that people are potentially dying from misinformation on this. And so we would maybe potentially investigate supporting a legislative change to Section 230 of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which is what protects a lot of social media companies in general from lawsuits. And what he was basically saying was that we think that you are being irresponsible. And so we believe we may need to change the way the entire industry is regulated. Of course, this would require convincing Congress to go along with it, too. That was the threat, that maybe they would support a legislative change that was almost certainly never going to happen. That is not the same thing as going in and saying, I'm going to fuck with your broadcast licenses.
Which is executive authority.
Which is executive authority.
Doesn't need Congress.
I'm just going to go and do this. Yeah. We are going to do absolute lawfare against you. Those are not equal.
Yeah.
That is not the same kind of infringement. And just like that, it's like, let's not do false equivalence here. Let's if you are on the liberal side, if you consider yourself a small L liberal, if you're conservative, you're Republican, I think I've talked to Vic about healthcare stuff. I think his opinions are interesting on a lot of topics and he's a useful counterweight to my impulses on topics like universal coverage or how to approach it. But like if you are a small L liberal, like don't try to play this down. Just do not. Like this should be seen as a bridge too far. This is not the kind of thing you would want either party. And I will say there have been times where Democrats have in the past, played footsie with some of this kind of thing around broadcasters. There was a time when when Sinclair broadcast, the big conservative, they broadcast this whole thing about like the fake news media. They made all their
local
anchors
like
read a script that was very weird and North Korea-ish.
Yeah.
But a bunch of Democratic senators wrote a thing to the FCC saying they should be investigated for distorting the news and potentially, you know, maybe there should be a complaint about their licenses. That's not great either. That was not like, that's the closest I could find that Democrats ever come to this. But like, that was not good. But like, let's not pretend that this situation isn't kind of unique and scary.
Yeah.
That's my,
I totally agree with you. And I get really frustrated about there's like this impulse to do both sidesism on this thing because Republicans, I think, and people on the right who are, I think, sincerely concerned about free speech in general, like not, you know, the people who don't give a shit, but like the ones who do care, are, I think, annoyed at how many liberals were quiet at potential infringements on free speech when Democrats were in control and when there wasn't a Trump presidency. And like, I understand that. Like, I think that that's like a fair hit to be like, hey, like, I'm annoyed that more of you weren't speaking up when there were free speech violations in the past. And not like, I mean, again, like, it wasn't the government doing it, but yeah, there were like, there was a culture of like hostility towards open speech that like developed in a lot of spaces. But I just don't get why we can't hold these two things in the same time and like go like, okay, well, like, what's happening right now though? Like, what's going on in this moment that the federal government is using its power? Like, are we seriously saying, like, even if you had the viewpoint that the Democrats had done something bad on free speech, like, that means this is the time to bring that up when there's a potential, like, you know, complete abrogation of responsibility from the FCC chairman to maintain his neutrality and not just use his political.
Yeah.
Yeah, I find it like really frustrating, but I'm also just like, I don't know. Like, I don't know how you get more people who I do think, I would guess, I don't know Avik well or anything like that, but like, I would guess he actually does care about free speech and like does not
I
want it.
He,
yeah.
Yeah, no,
he
does. I think he does.
I'm just like, how do you get people like that to be like, okay, I'm also concerned about the Trump administration's infringements on speech.
I mean, the line that the MAGA movement has drawn on this is like hate speech, right? That's the thing. The second that Pam Bondi says like, or this week was like, oh, we're gonna try to prosecute hate speech. That's when like Tucker Carlson was like, absolutely not.
Yeah,
just do not.
She like walked it back a little bit because which is good. Like that seems like the backlash got to her.
But it was like, so there is a line, but again, it's the false equivalence that it's just like, people don't just admit we're in Terra Nova.
Yeah,
we're in Terra Nova.
And so like, Jordan hates hypocrisy.
Yeah,
don't do it.
Don't do it,
Jordan. Thank you for coming to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
The Arguments production team includes Ranjini Chakraborty, Isabella Pereira, Angela Tracy, Kate Crawford, and Eli Richman. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to hear more from The Argument, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. On the track, my car's look is everything. But today, I'm talking about more than just paint schemes. I'm talking about my favorite games at Chumba Casino. Check out exclusives like Stampede Fury and my own King Croc Fury. It's just as wild as my car look in Texas. With over 200 games and new ones weekly, play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.